Okay, so we'll begin our continuation of the afternoon session. This will be more around the nuts and bolts, hands-on, in a non-Buddhist culture. What do we do? How do we do it? Jeannie and Debbie will begin, but we were going to a talk of Ajahn-Yeti Ghosh, just to hear an example of his reflections in a Christian church in Canada, where I'm sure he was the only Buddhist there.
Rana was there.
Huh? Rana. Oh, Rana. Yeah, Rana made the effort to go up for that. And then Dennis was going to have a thought as well.
Quick announcement. While everybody's still here, if you would like to experience firsthand a Buddhist memorial ceremony for Iris Landsberg, who, dear friend and Upasika, who passed away in January, next Sunday, that will be happening right here. So please feel free to come along. Begin with the meal offering at the usual time, and the ceremony will follow in the afternoon. And also, some of her friends had the idea to set up the Iris Landsberg Memorial Building Fund. So if you'd like to make a contribution, that will help go toward the construction of the new building. So you can just jot down on your donation that you'd like it to go to the Iris's Building Fund, and then that will be kept track of as part of that. So that's next Sunday. So just wanted to mention that while
and her non-Buddhist family are offering the meal. And if people want to come and bring a potluck dish to offer or something, that's most welcome.
Ken's very sweet. I mean, they've been had contact with us, of course. Mm-hmm. And they're really as excited as you can get for more and more for your daughter. But, they're just so appreciative of the place that the monastery had, the importance that it had for help for iron.
And it's interesting because they're from a non-Buddhist background,
yeah.
And so that meeting of people and cultures.
Yeah. Okay, so that's how the transmission of how the start is sent.
Less than 10 days ago, I was sitting in Sri Lanka, talking with my brother, having just decided that he was going through such a difficult time, as was quite common, in his history. And it almost became the norm for us that we would sit down and we would talk for, as many have said, hours and hours about not just him, but the various difficulties in our lives and so forth. And it was just 10 days ago, and it seems like, since then my whole world has been kind of turned completely upside down. So maybe I'll just begin with a small introduction. By the way, you'll notice I'm giving a reflection, which is different from a eulogy. And maybe in the course of what I say, that will become clear why it's somewhat different. So my name is Ajahn Yeti Ghosh. I'm a Buddhist monk, and I have been for over 22 years now. This church brings back incredible memories for me. I was confirmed in this church when I was a little guy, and back in the old days when it used to be the different church, the old church, I remember very clearly, and much of my moral sensitivities and love for humanity and for truth very much came from what I'd learned in this church, in this environment. So I feel very grateful. I should add, I've always been terrible with faces, but especially faces that have aged 20 years since I last saw you. You have to forgive me for not recognizing many of you. So I went to, when I was about 20, I went to Thailand, and my parents were terrified. I kind of sent a letter home saying I was going to become a Buddhist monk, and My father thought this was ridiculous, and my mother thought it was a cult. You know, they knew nothing about Buddhism, and it was just a, who can blame them? You know, they didn't know anything about Buddhism, and you assume the worst. It's a prejudice based on not understanding something. There are many ways of narrating our past to ourselves. And when I look at what's, what it was that caused me to become a Buddhist monk, I could explain it in a variety of different ways. But one, certainly, perhaps the primary way of describing it is through the influence of my brother. Like my sister, he was my hero. My sister wasn't my hero, but my... he was also a hero. And when I was about 12, he got into bodybuilding. And with that philosophy of self-development. And I was enamored. We spent hours and hours and hours him talking and me listening together. And I remember one incident, I could take it no longer. And I got up from the table and I went to my bedroom and got a like stand-up picture frame, brought it back, and it was a picture of myself, and I put it on the table. I said, here, talk to this. And, so Glenn was an idea man. He loved ideas, he loved insights, and he loved to talk about them. And it took him many years of suffering to learn the skill of listening, something that eventually he became uniquely gifted at when he set his mind to it, which was actually more often than many might think. As he strove to develop himself, he became obsessed, it seemed, with whatever might make him a better human, a better person. And it was to take a major breakdown and years of family and friend support for him to learn that what mattered in life was not charisma or charm or status, but integrity and authenticity. Humility was not necessarily the strong point. We came across a journal. Now, I think he'd have a good laugh if I read this. I just think, well, this is a journal that was given to him from a friend of his, Keith Burgess. 1984, where Glenn came to the kind of remarkable insight and conclusion that, you know, physical perfection and intellectual refinement are such terribly superfluous goals. My humble brother. But this insane idealism that he had in his teens and early 20s had its consequences, and what happened after his university graduation, after being hired by IBM for, I think, a week or something like that, he had a breakdown, a very real breakdown, a total breakdown. And I would spend, again, hours and hours and hours talking with him, more than I truly believe anyone would believe, discussing the meaning of life, the nature of happiness, the nature of authenticity, and the ethics of suicide. Even then, it was an issue for him. And this very much influenced me, and I have to say for the better. For me, it helped liberate my mind from certain biases and prejudices that I had learned from the world around me. And I went on a search of my own. I went first to a Christian monastery in Quebec, and it actually led me to a Buddhist monastery in Thailand, where I was to spend 17 years of my life. So I feel that I'm in a bit of a unique situation. On the one hand, I'm Glenn's younger brother, and I can easily say that there's no one on earth who could ever replace the connection that we had. We were like, and I've often said, we were like Siamese twins joined in the soul. We shared the same blood, the same consciousness, the same vocabulary, and the same language. But I'm also a Buddhist monk, someone who has something to say about the fact that he killed himself. Something that is important for me to say, something that through saying, I feel that I'm affirming something about my brother. Truth was important to my brother. And if I had to sum up his life in a sentence, it would be Glenn's life was about the search for authenticity and freedom. And such a search always starts out naive. Authenticity means more or less ignoring the feelings of others. And freedom means just doing what you want, when you want. But there's something about the interplay between these two aspects that forces one to mature. And Glenn went through the phase of arrogance and impulsivity, and it took a while, but he was moving through them to a state of self-understanding and centered action, but it was a hard slog. And it's my feeling that recently he had tried to face truth about himself and his world that he was not prepared to face and with which he could not deal. So how does one understand suicide? This is a very important question to me. There are religious responses to this. Different religions will say different things about suicide, and perhaps Pastor Barber will speak to this later. So let me first preface this by just saying that what I say here is just my perspective as a Buddhist monk. I'm not saying anything absolute by any means. It will speak to some of you Buddhists, some Christian or otherwise or not, and it will not speak to others. So just take this like a smorgasbord, where you kind of you go down the smorgasbord and you just take what you like and you just leave the rest. There's no need to argue about anything. And I just should add, and I can't help it, this is no way to approach a teaching as a whole once you've committed to it, to just take what you like. But it's fair enough when you're just opening yourself to some reflections. Because suicide is such a momentous thing, a rare thing, a thing that seems like it shouldn't happen, and incredibly a thing of shame, and because of this we don't talk about it, we don't understand it. Is it a bad thing? Is it, as the Stoics thought, a noble thing if you do it mindfully? Is it cowardice? Is it selfish? Or is it selfish of us to want a suicidal person to just stay alive so that we are happy? These are incredibly interesting and valid, important points to reflect upon. I think a starting point in considering this is to remember that we never, ever truly understand where another person is in their suffering and in their despair. To pass a judgment on it, even as noble or courageous or cowardice or whatever, is to assume an understanding of the being that does not belong to us. It is the mentality of judgmentalism that contributed to my brother's difficulties in the first place, and it is something that him and I have rallied against in our own way all our lives. For me, as a Buddhist, and this I'm sure would apply to Christians as well, and atheists even, there are two truths that we have to take refuge in as humans. First one is life is precious. So just to be alive, to be conscious, to be capable of feeling, and to be capable of making choices are marvelous, holy things. Things that are so close to us, they're hard to see, they're hard to appreciate. It's like the fish in the water. You know, the capacity to choose, we just take for granted. But in that capacity to choose, we have the capacity to choose to do good things, to do caring things, to do loving things. So life is precious. And B, all things change. This last one was something that for my brother, he was just incapable of seeing. I think I just lost the fuzzy. Don't worry about it. It was, my brother was unable to see in his final days for some reason that we, his family and loved ones, can understand. He was unable to be open to the possibility of change. The future was reduced to a certainty, a hopeless certainty, and nothing could possibly come in to intervene and to make it be otherwise. From a Buddhist perspective, let us be clear, suicide is a mistake. It is not something to flirt with. It is not something to idealize, romanticize, or make light of. It is the ending of a process that, in our opinion, is extraordinarily rare and of immense worth. But what we must remember, and this is about everything I would like to leave us with today, is that every action we commit in our lives, be it noble or selfish, be it mundane or profound, be it through mind, body, mind, or speech, all our actions matter. And they create our world. They define our relationships. All actions that are based on intention, according to Buddhism, are consequential for the world and for ourselves. And this, for those of you who may not know, is the concept of karma. It's the notion that we're responsible for all our actions when they're based on intention. And the world is carved out for us through these actions. So suicide is a mistake in my view, a big mistake. Why? Because every moment is a moment to grow, to share, to inquire, to exercise the muscle of authenticity, to learn the skills of love and contentment. And suicide ends that process short, painful though that process may be. And yet it does not define a life. Between the bookends of birth and death and the life of my brother was a world, a massive world of love and concern for humanity, a real desire for truth, and a determination to nurture and encourage the seeds of trust within himself and between himself and others. How many lives has my brother's life touched? What makes his life wonderful is not that he achieved anything in the world per se. It wasn't his paycheck, or it wasn't his status or lack of it. It was that his heart was well-meaning. He longed for authenticity in a way that affected and infected everyone who knew him. My being is immeasurably richer thanks to my brother, and so is my sister's, so is Reyes, so is my mother's, so is Katie's. The list goes on and on. All this goodness that is spread from his heart to ours, from his mind to ours, is a result of the good intentions and caring motivations that he nourished within and celebrated without. Just about done here. So suicide is always tragic. It is, in my view, almost certainly always an error. But that doesn't render his life meaningless by a long shot. He ended it prematurely, but before he did, he brought more brightness, beauty, and truthfulness relating to this world than many who lived for a century. For us, we can redeem his life to some degree, in my opinion, by bringing the best that Glenn had inside him into our own life. The courage to be who he was, the passion to become who he was, and the love to allow others to be who they are, all within the context of love and concern. These are the matters that are central to my brother's life, and incidentally, an important foundation to my Buddhist practice here, but I imagine any spiritual practice. Forgive me if I sound preachy in this talk, but it seems kind of necessary to me. My brother, Buddhism, authenticity and love all conspire to define my relationship with Glenn. And as I rejoice in who my brother was and share with you all a bit of that love, it is crucial that I share with you these elements that made up this relationship. So Glenn, you holy goofball, more important now than the love that I feel is gratitude, and I'm so, so grateful to have been a part of your life, and I wish you well wherever death may take you.
Kind of hard to follow.
Yeah. We have a commercial or something. We could just meditate for the next hour. Shall I try? Okay. I've listened to that reflection a couple of times before, and it moved me quite a bit. So what I'd like to speak about briefly is I was serving the winter retreat here, fortunately, this past winter. And during that time, just before it began, I learned that my stepmother, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's about 2 years ago, was going to be entering hospice. And so I knew that during the course of the retreat, it was quite likely that she would die. And the community was generous in anticipating and giving permission up front for me to leave the retreat as necessary for short amounts of time. And so I want to just talk a little bit about the experience of being a Buddhist in the context of my stepmother's death and my family. And there are a couple of things that come to mind. My family is not Buddhist. I'm the only Buddhist member of my family. And in fact, my father is very actively atheist. I mean, he's not a member of the society or anything, but he's an actuary. And when he had a heart attack some years ago, I said, "Dad, were you scared?" He said, "No, you know, I knew I was going to die sometime." So that's kind of, you know, in some ways he has a very genuinely equanimous attitude to
towards death. And so he was quite full of grief during this process of my stepmother declining. And at the time that she was going to go into hospice, she, after living in various facilities, she still recognized everybody more or less, and she still remembered her life. And she had stopped being able to eat. Or she moved, she was living in a Catholic facility, and that's important. She had moved there because it was taking two people to lift her, and she needed to be in a place where that was acceptable. And she had an advance directive. She didn't want any, you know, she didn't want to be kept alive artificially, and my whole family was supportive of that. But at some point, she lost the ability to eat, and so she, the home where she was, contacted my stepbrother and asked for permission to put a feeding tube in. And I think no one really understood the ramifications of that. So a feeding tube was put in, and then once it was in, it could not be removed at the facility where she was. So my family's concern was that she could be alive and in a vegetative state, you know, for quite a long time. So it took quite a long time for her to get from where she was into hospice. And along the way, I wasn't involved in this process, but and this is one point I wanted to bring up, that my stepmother did a really wonderful job of articulating to the facility where she was why we wanted her to be, to have the feeding tube removed. And the people at the facility very lovingly and respectfully said, no, we can't do that because of our beliefs. So there are these gaps. If you, even if you have an advanced directive, you can't always see the ramifications of decisions that are made, even when they're made, even when they're the best decision at the time. So anyway, she ended up finding a place where she could be in hospice, contracting with a hospice service, because this is how it works in LA, apparently, and being moved from where she was to a hospital, having the feeding tube removed, staying at my stepbrother's house with private care overnight, and then going to the hospice where she ultimately died, because they couldn't accept her with a feeding tube and not use it. So this all took about, you know, 48 hours or something. And during that time, she was quite alert and happy because she was surrounded by people who loved her, and she still had nutrition. But when she got to the hospice, she really was ready to die. And so she let go very quickly, day by day. There was a change. And at that point, I went down. And so I had a lot of opportunity to think about what, how I wanted to be, what I could bring to the situation. And I knew that my father was very uncomfortable being around her. I think he was just so aggrieved that he couldn't tolerate being with her for very long. So he would go see her, but he couldn't, you know, he'd make the hour drive and then half an hour later say, well, I gotta go. So at the point where she, having reflected on death and dying and having some experience with people dying, I knew that when someone isn't responsive, they can still hear. So I was able to tell my father that, which he had no idea of, and just that allowed him to be more comfortable just expressing his love for her. And at this point, she was still alert enough that when we entered the room, they had a very happy marriage. So her eyes would just follow my father, and she would kind of light up. So that was, I thought that that was a real benefit. And My brother also is almost phobic about hospitals, hospices, and death. And so just by being a calm, confident, and clear presence there, I felt like that allowed him to be present as well. So I think that's the main thing for me is having, as a Buddhist, reflected on death, you know, the daily reflections and the constant encouragement to look at it as a reality for everyone we know and for ourselves, then to bring that at least passing familiarity and superficial comfort with it to other people was beneficial. Another thing that is sort of tangentially related to what we've been talking about, but I think it comes out of practice, is being willing to be being comfortable with other people's discomfort. So at one point, when my stepmother was no longer responsive but clearly could benefit from someone being there and swabbing her lips and stuff like that, my father kind of said, "Okay, you can go home now." And he's my father. And so I kind of did, like I laughed. And then I thought, wait a minute, I know that that it's beneficial for people to be there. So I just went back, and the next time my dad came to visit, there I was. I hadn't gone anywhere. So that was interesting. Let's see what else. I'll just skip because I don't want to go on too long. But then after she died, inspired by John's example, another member of the retreat crew, his mother died at the beginning of the retreat. So the two of us decided to do a meal offering, and then everybody on the retreat and beyond got involved. And we made a giant Indian meal for the Sangha, which was lovely to do. And we had a great time doing it. And then just last week, I came out of retreat and I had dinner with my father and my aunt and other members of my family who, you know, probably will never come to the monastery, and it's okay, but they don't want to come here. And just sharing with them what we had done and describing the whole process, everybody getting involved. There was just, they lit up and there was such a feeling of mudita and of just the blessings of that continuing on. So I think there are so many other ways that practice helped me. The community chanted for her on the day that she died, and so feeling the support here when I was there, feeling the support of the community here, was wonderful. And I was driving through LA to get to the hospice, and I was like listening to some music, and I thought, no, wait a minute. So I started listening to the 28 Buddhas protection chant, and that really helped me when I was there. And it helped me also, there can be a lot of fireworks among, you know, old family dynamics can come up and bring a lot of dukkha. And so that happened one of my first visits. And so the next time in between, I reflected, well, how do I want to go and be with my family? And I just thought, well, I want to go as a samana, as, you know, someone who's cultivating peace. And if referring to the Akabat Sutta, which some of you are familiar with, if I just look after myself, my own body and speech and mind, that's enough, that's all I can do. But that helped create harmony in the whole family, even in a very stressful situation. Thank you.
So I'll try to fill in just from my experience a little bit around some of what has been said today. And I know there's a lot of people in this room who have work around death or have experienced death of loved ones, and there's a wealth of experience just in this room. So these are just my experiences and just some thoughts that I have around them. I never was around death very much until I think the first...
Until I came to the monastery.
And then the people that invited me to live on their property, which is now Casa Serena, where the women stay, Peter was diagnosed with lung cancer at the same time as a dear friend of mine down in the peninsula was diagnosed with lung cancer. And she'd already had a double mastectomy over the years, so she'd had her fair share. And so it's kind of going on with both of them. And I ended up being a caregiver for Mary, which I'd never done before. This seems to be the way I do things. I kind of just jump in to things I've never had any experience with, and it's a great learning environment. That Mary was very fortunate, and Peter, I didn't actually take care of. I was more supportive for his wife, Mary. And then 2 years later, she was diagnosed with colon cancer, and I became her caregiver for about 6 weeks, I think. And that was a blessing because we were right next door to the monastery, and every day Ajahn Pasano came over in the morning and spent a half hour, 45 minutes just to be available if Mary had questions, or he would just sit quietly with her. And then Ajahn Kirunadamo had a lot of nursing experience, so there was always somebody at hand who could offer a lot of support, and then I could do the hands-on with Mary's sister who was there helping out. And in the end, we felt, and she even, Mary's sister said at the memorial, she said she lost a sister, but she felt like she gained a sister. And it really did feel very much that way. And then my last winter retreat, I was down visiting my parents because my mom's health was not very good. We'd already thought we were going to lose her. She had congestive heart failure she also had something called Kress syndrome, which is an autoimmune thing, and her lungs basically were turning into some kind of parchment kind of tissue, and the efficacy was diminishing. So I was down at my parents', and it was actually my dad's birthday at that point, so my brother from Seattle was there, and his two kids were there also, and he got word that his wife had died suddenly in the shower, had a heart attack, and so I went back to help him with whatever he had to face, and there was a lot to face on many levels. So in that instance, that was with my mom. My mom died last June. My sister-in-law died in February, last February. My mom, we knew she was going to go. We finally got word that it was time to go on palliative care, and I have been reflecting on death a lot over the years, and I knew my mom was going to go, and even with that, I went in to pay my respects to Lumpur and take my leave, and I just couldn't hold it together because I was like, I don't want to be going down there for this, because I knew that I was going down to take care of my mom until she died, and I also knew that there was nothing else and nowhere else that I would have gone, that I would be doing. That was what I wanted to do as well, even though I didn't want to be doing it. So that, I guess, in those experiences, kind of one thought that's come up in hearing a lot of this stuff is, you know, there's a lot of workshops that are offered about death and dying. People do hospice, and I've never done a hospice training, and I bet anything they cover this. But we get a lot of ideals about death and dying, and one thing that I think is really important is this thing about uncertainty. We do not know what the experience is going to be like. Death is not a pretty thing. It's the breakup of the body. It's written in the suttas everywhere about the breakup of the body. And you know, my mom, because it was so close, I saw it more clearly. And it was very difficult to watch that happen. My mom, one thing that was really lovely is my mom and dad have a very strong Catholic background. They have a lot of faith. And so one thing that I did with my mom a year before she died, when we thought she was dying, is I basically asked forgiveness, which is very much a Buddhist tradition, but I didn't use those words. So I made it more general, and I just said, Mom, there's things I've done in my life that I have a lot of regret about. And my mom was right there, and she said, I forgive you. And then I said it to my dad because, you know, we never know. And my dad was a little less comfortable with it. He said, oh, you haven't done anything. So, and that was good enough. That was, you know. And my sister was there. And for my sister, this is really hard stuff for her to face. It's just she doesn't have that strength. She doesn't realize she has the strength. And what she feels more is the attachment side. And just what she was focused on was more, how am I going to live when my mom dies? My mom's my best friend. So in the end, what happened is I was with my mom all the time. And my mom had confidence in me. She trusted me. She felt I was strong in inwardly and outwardly. And to my mom, that gave a lot of peace. And so I became the administrator of the medicines, and that's not a choice I would have made because I'm not really familiar with medicines, and I could call hospice, but I felt very much on my own. And then you have to face the thing of, you know, my mom, her experience in the hospitals in the past was that medicine, some of the medicines, she had strong hallucinations, and they were frightening hallucinations for her. So then what I saw come up was, well, I want her to be comfortable, but if we give her too much, she's not going to be accessible to us. And I had to really let go of that. I mean, I was there for my mom, so that really wasn't too much of an issue, but also how much is enough and how much, you know, is going to make her have these horrible hallucinations. And I did have to deal with her having some horrible hallucinations. I would sit up. There were at least two or three nights where everybody else was asleep and my mom and I were sitting there and she was filled with fear because of what she thought was happening. And we would just sit and talk. And that's where I'm really grateful for the training, because if you've sat with a mind that kind of goes all over the place and you've done that a lot, then it's helpful to be with someone else. It allows you to find a ground, a center, that allows you to be with that. You can tap into your breath. And just that knowledge that I was there for her helped a lot, because it was like, okay, this isn't about me. I don't want this to be happening. And then also trying to be creative. What can I say to her that will help her relax around this? And finally, in the end, the one time I just called her on, I said, Mom, you know, you said you trusted me. Do you trust me? And she said, yeah, I trust you. And then I said, Mom, if you trust me, can you trust that, I realize that this feels very real to you, but can you trust that there's a possibility that not all of this is real, that some of this could be the medicine? And she said, okay, I can trust that. And then I said, then I think all you can do right now is just pray and ask God to give you strength and guidance and peace. And then she went to bed and she went to sleep. And she told me the next morning that had been really helpful. You know, I was grabbing straws. I didn't know what else to do. So, you know, the practice gives us that center to respond from. And you have to kind of be present, not knowing what the next thing that's going to happen is. And you can count on it that it's going to be unexpected. So, and there were times that were not pretty. There was some tension with my sister at times because of certain things that I won't go into. And there was one night where I kind of responded in a really strong way to something that my sister was doing, and then she got really upset, and we were in the room with my mom. And I immediately saw, oh my gosh, this is just exactly what I don't want to bring into my mom's room while she's dying. But then I apologized to my sister later, with my mom and dad there, and I just said, you know, we kind of lost it. And, you know, so it's just, you have to be prepared for all of this stuff, and you're never going to know exactly what's going to happen. My mom, my dad, I was concerned about him. 9 days before my mom passed, they had celebrated 63 years of marriage.
Ooh.
They were very close. It's not like they spent all day, every day together, but they were in the same house. And my dad would go up and do his thing, and then he would come down and sit, and he would talk to my mom for 10 minutes. And, you know, and he notices that lack. So now it's shifted into talking to my dad. Oh, there's just going back to my mom, a couple things that, and this may not work for everybody, so it's just, it worked with my mom. We talked about her death, asked her how she felt about it. She was able to talk about it, because after a year and a half of congestive heart failure symptoms and times when you feel like you can't breathe and complete lack of energy, you know, she could hardly walk across the room without getting winded. And, you know, she was moving closer and closer to a place of acceptance. I talked to her about after she died. I said, I would like to wash the body with anybody in the family who'd like to participate. How would you feel about that? And she was like, if you want to do that, that's okay. And mom, if we do that, what would you like us to put you in? You know, it doesn't seem important, but it's kind of like it's helping her and us kind of take that next step. Even though it wasn't real at that moment, it's still moving in that direction. And so she said, oh, it doesn't matter what I'm in. And then I think it was the next day, she said, well, you know, you know that black and white shirt? So there was something kind of sweet in that. And then I talked to her and I told, because when my sister-in-law had died, we did a meal offering here in honor of her. And my family didn't come, but I let them know what was happening. We took photographs. But Jeannie and Beth and other people participated, and Sandra brought some food, and we did it in honor of my sister-in-law. So I told, and my mom had known that I'd done that, so I asked my mom, I said, you know, we did the meal offering in honor of Sherry, and we shared that merit with her. And I want to do that for you. Is there any kind of food that you would like to have us offer? And she said immediately, whatever the monks would like the most. So, you know, and in that way, then when we did that ceremony, she had already participated in that. She had already benefited from that in herself. And, you know, in some ways it was really hard watching someone die and being with someone through that process, especially someone who you were attached through an umbilical cord for all those months in the womb. And I don't know if I ever could have been prepared for what the separation actually felt like. It's been wretched in moments. But we have the opportunity to say these things, and we don't always. So another thing it's something that I've always held important is when I leave people, and you hear this all the time, but boy, when you realize how abrupt and how finite, how final death feels, really don't ever let those bad moments last for very long. And if they do something that helps you clean out any bad feeling, and that, you know, that you can ask for forgiveness after the person is gone. You can still communicate with them. It comes from here.
So how your family responded to the emotion.
Yeah, so when my mom did that, and also my sister, who had a really hard time with this. My mom could no longer go in the shower, so my sister and I bathed her, and I asked my sister, do you want to help? My mom was remarkable. As soon as she could not do it herself, she was completely at ease with us helping her. And I think that's exceptional. That's not something I think is witnessed very often. I think usually it takes some time to adjust to having people wipe you, bathe you, but... So my sister and I bathed my mom, and my sister took the areas of the body that she was most comfortable with, which meant the legs or the arms or the washing the hair. But my sister emailed me later, and she said, that was the most profound thing I've ever done in my life, and that will stay with me forever. And then after my mom died, there were a few of us with her through the night. My sister happened to be the one with her, which I think was my mom's last gift to my sister. My sister was the one with her when she actually took her last breath. And we were there within moments because we were all just downstairs. And so we called everybody, and people came, and then we said, let's bathe the body. Does anybody who wants to help bathe the body can help, and if you don't want to, it's okay. Well, my 11-year-old nephew did not want to, and so he didn't, and it was completely open. But I was shocked because I didn't expect this. My father, two of my brothers, my sister-in-law, my 17-year-old niece, my sister, and myself, we just all were involved in bathing the body. My sister, my dad, and I, just out of respect for my mother, did the more private areas, and we dressed her. And then she died in the morning, and this was totally open. I had no idea this would happen either, but it just unfolded, and I think this is important, is to let things unfold. We were there with the body for a good 6 hours, and what ended up happening is some of the neighbors came in, much against their comfort, but they weren't forced. They came on their own will. One of the neighbors heard, immediately had flowers come in, and my nephew and niece were laying next to the body, holding her. My niece wrote a letter to her and read it out. My other sister-in-law came with my two nephews, and they did some prayers. And I couldn't have asked for anything more special, because it was such a powerful time for everybody, just to be together and to see it's a body, but also to be with that body. And I've experienced this before, so you know, you think everything's going smoothly, and then it was time to take the body away, and they came to take the body. And so I got up right away to go deal with the people. And as I was walking out of the room to go down and do the paperwork, this thought was, oh my God, I'm never going to see her again. And it's kind of, you know, you just don't know what's going to come up. You just have to be ready for anything and be real patient with yourself. The neighbors rallied. I mean, people really came forward. So it's just giving the space for that to happen, I think. Really not trying to define things too much. And then we did a meal offering here, and Nook's mother had died, and so Nook and I talked about, well, why don't we just do our meal offering together? And then pretty soon other people got involved, and we set up a table, and we put the pictures, and people came, I didn't even know were coming, and they brought their pictures, and we had a table full of pictures of people who had died with this meal offering. And Jeannie and I had a special offering that we wanted to make, a reliquary that we've gotten in Hawaii for Ajahn Chah's ashes when we have our new building. And it was very joyful, and part of that joy was that fact that we're all related in birth, maybe old age, but sickness and death. And just that joining in that, we shared the joy of doing something positive, and that was really uplifting. And then now, traditionally in Thailand, when somebody dies, people will print Dhamma books and share them with their loved one, in honor of their loved one. So I've kind of had it in the back of my head that I want to do something like that. So right now I'm transcribing talks, and Lumpur Tata retreat, on a metta retreat back in 2008. And so I'm transcribing the talks right now. And as I do that, I'm sharing the merit with my mother. So as I'm getting tired of type, 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 oh, what was that? Go back, reverse, go back, listen again. What is it? Type, 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 type. Oh, wait, what was that? And I start to feel, this is for mom. And so it's a point of practice, as well as sharing the merit, and something that will also feel beneficial to others. And I think that's important, and those are things we can keep doing. You know, you can do it on those days, the 40 days or 100 days, but really, let's just do it whenever it arises and it feels like appropriate. So those are some of the main points that I was thinking of, is just kind of like, don't think your past experience is going to be what your experience is this time, because it's undefined, it's uncertain. And you know, my experiences with Peter and Mary, and even with Jay when he died, I felt a lot of joy after they died. When my mom died, I felt joy that she was out of that suffering, but very soon afterwards, the grief just came right in. So, you know, we just have to really keep paying attention, be open to... my brother came while my mom was... A couple of days before she died, she was still conscious and actually did a rosary with her. It was fantastic. It was very beautiful to witness. So it's just kind of being open to what others have to bring in as well. So, yes.
Just on that, but what others have to bring. That day you had that meal offering, we were in Yosemite.
Yeah.
And say what Ajahn Janako did.
Yeah. Oh, so Ajahn Janako, his... So it kind of, we were trying to figure a date, and the date that Nook and I could do it was a date when five members of the community were on their week away into Yosemite, and Ajahn Janako was one of those people, and his grandfather had died a year ago November. So we wanted to include...
His cousin, too.
Oh, and his cousin, too, that's right.
Yeah, we wanted, his cousin
had died very suddenly, so we wanted... We were going to include them. I had photographs. And so they were in Yosemite and couldn't be there, but they knew it was happening. And that day, he hiked to the top of Mount Daniel in Yosemite. And what did he have? He had
a few sacred objects.
Yeah. So he and Tangkasapo, I think, were up there. And they probably burned some incense and did some chanting.
Yeah.
And then they put these and put stones and made a little chetty up there.
Mm-hmm.
So they participated from afar.
Mm-hmm. On top of the mountain, and actually there were some other people up there, and I think they explained to them what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite lovely.
Mm. Anyway, that's just some thoughts, and I'm sure everybody has some amazing stories and things to share. I do want to say one more thing, because I think it's important. I have to own up to one thing, and that's it. As soon as I got back to the monastery and had the space, because I was with my dad for a month, what started coming up was doubt. And I don't think this is uncommon either. Did I do the right thing? I was in charge of the medicines. Was she really as comfortable as she could have been? And I tell you, that's self-torture. So, you know, you do have to be... I didn't see that coming. And I promised her. She said, whatever, I don't want you to feel bad, whatever happens. And I said I wouldn't, and I did. So I've asked her forgiveness a few times. And that's kind of, you know, it's not hitting as hard now, but I had to do a lot of work around that and remind myself that I was there for her, and I really did give her 100%. And it's just where the mind goes. So that's all. Really.
Questions, comments?
I have a question. Have you found that there's a difference between being afraid of death and being afraid of dying?
I'm sure there's a difference. But since I haven't ever experienced that sensation that I'm dying, I'm not sure. I like what Edward said, you know. I'm still making mistakes, so obviously I'm not really getting it. but yeah, it's not easy to watch someone die, but it's still them dying. And what you're facing is separation. You're not facing your own death, so I'm not quite so sure that they're equal. But that's just my take on it.
Yeah, okay. That's good. That's perfect.
Apropos of that, kind of something I was thinking about too is how useful the reflection on karma has been to me at watching my, you know, this person kind of disappear through the course of Alzheimer's and also just other loss in life and in contemplating one's own death, as Edward pointed to. So that as my stepmother was dying, and after talking with Ajahn Kunadamo, we had talked about the benefit of, you know, one of the most important things being creating or maintaining a sense of calm around the dying person. I just reflected so much on my stepmother's life, even as her capacities kind of seemed to go down the drain. And she was really a good person. She did, I mean, she after she was divorced and left with three young kids, she became a lawyer and she became a child advocate and guardian for children and served on the grand jury in Los Angeles County and just had such integrity and such love of children. And that really helped me with grief as she was dying. And when I would be sitting with her and ready to, you know, break up and not know what to say, I just felt like I could say to her and for myself, you live such a good life. And she went through a period of fear and then seemed to let go. And the last day that she was able to speak, whenever anyone got close to her, she said, "I love you." So it was just, and that's really like, it was the distillation of who she had been in life. Not that she was perfect, because nobody is, but just that encouragement to reflect on that comma is the only thing we can take with us is has been beneficial for me.
And I'm just having one more thought, and that's my nephew's 11. My nephew and niece, from the day they were each born, spent their days during the week with my parents because both their parents worked. So my parents were their second parents, very attached to my parents. My nephew would come and sit on, and my mom would just be sitting on the couch because that's all she could do. He'd come home and just put his head on her shoulder. And we wondered how he was processing all of this because everybody was talking about it. We weren't hiding anything. And they came over to the house with great regularity. And it was difficult because my mom, when they were in the house, they were the last people she actually looked at and smiled at. Mm-hmm. Because when they were in the house, she wanted to be there for them. We weren't really sure how my nephew was dealing with it, and children are very different than adults, and I'm sure there's books written about this and I haven't read them. but with my nephew, one day I was sitting on the couch where my mom usually sat, and she was still alive, she was upstairs, and she was in the active process of dying, but he looked at me, and his mom was sitting there, but he looked at me and he said, "Aunt Debbie, do you think Grandma's ever going to sit on the couch again?" And I was like, "Oh." And I said, "No, CJ, I don't think so." And he said, "I don't either." And then, of course, I went, and my nephew just went. So, you know, it's just a...
thought that, you know, I think it's so hard sometimes to impart, particularly in the Western world, is the naturalness of death. In some cultures, it just seems like it's a bit more experienced as just, you know, part of the natural process and accepted. People are with it a lot more, you know, year after year, day after day, person after person, including people who are dying, that kind of stuff. But it seems more as a just a part of a natural process.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to get people to kind of reflect on that. You know, people think it's wrong or it's not right or it's something exceptional or it's going to necessarily be horrible, you know, that kind of thing, but it's not supposed to be that way.
Yeah.
But just if you can get, you know, slowly over time, you need your own idea that this is the way it's supposed to be. People are supposed to die. You know, and working with people who are losing their loved ones to just maybe see it just with a little bit more lightness and not quite so much heaviness.
That's one advantage of having my mom be at home, and I think Jeannie experienced some of this with her nephews and nieces, and they were around the process. And, you know, my mom's anniversary was 9 days before she died, and she was so excited that she made it to her anniversary that my mom was a red meat eater. She loved red meat. And so they went and got food from Black Angus and brought it home, and we took her bedside table. And we covered it with this gold tablecloth. And then my mom sat on the bed, and she had her oxygen tube in, and this was in her robe. And my dad sat across from her, and she could only eat, you know, little bits, but she was enjoying it so much, and my dad was enjoying it so much. And my mom, there were many moments when we did laugh, very lovely moments. So you can bring that into the process as well.
My stepbrother, who was lovely through all this and quite comfortable, he has twin girls who are 12 or 10, I think, and a son who's 7. And they were they visited their grandmother through all her decline, and he would email pictures of them kind of looked like she was at a spa, you know, one's brushing her hair and the others are massaging her and doing her nails and stuff. And so actually there's a little tension between my stepsister and my stepbrother, because his wife, because the boy, I'm sorry, he's 9, he wanted to come see her, see his grandmother, you know, a few hours before she died. My stepsister was coming, and he wanted to come. And he came, and he was so brave. You know, he was crying because he really was attached to her. But he was also staying right there. So they were there like 40 minutes before she died. And then afterwards, all the kids, after soccer and all that, they came back, and we all spent a while with her body too. And they were doing the same thing, kind of lovingly stroking her body and hugging her. And my family is, we have kind of a sense of humor that we all really enjoy. And so there was some lightness in the room. And at one point, one of the girls said, and she wasn't joking, but she's very smart. She knew that my stepmother wasn't breathing, but she said, "Oh, look, it looks like she's moving. Maybe we can revive her." And it was just really sweet. And I felt like those kids are going to be, they're just going to be at ease. And whoever they're with when they're dying, they're going to be quite fortunate. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll be me.
I like when the Buddha says that people like, well, I don't remember, but you know, people make investments like with money for their retirement, but the real stable investment is your merit.
Mm-hmm. We're the owners of our actions. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for sharing your story. I think this is, you know, I know it's a life for myself right now again. It's been constant the last couple years. And you can see it as a chaplain. And so someone had asked me, they go, "Doesn't this just break your heart, what you do in your life and things are going on?" I said, and I reflected, and then I really feel like the practice has really helped that. I said, "No, it's opened my heart."
Yeah.
Because it opens it to see the reality is the way things are. And I think what I've learned in sharing your stories, when we stop fixing the dying process, we're able to be with it in such a different way. And it can change the whole thing that happens when we stop that and just open the heart to the way things are.
Debbie mentioned about space, giving space, and I think that in the Western culture, and as Karina Damo alluded to it, that we're not really given enough space to be with death. It's something that's swept under the carpet. And there was a big contrast between when my father-in-law died, and he died at home with us, but the hospice came an hour or so after he died, and they immediately arranged for his body to be taken away. And my mother-in-law had been married 53 years. And she was distraught by that time, so hospice simply said, oh, give her a double dose of what? He's gonna have it. Which my husband did, and it knocked her out. And she came round and she said, where's Jim? Mm-hmm. Where's he gone? Mm-hmm. And I said, they've taken him. And again, she went through this terrible process. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the experience and enough knowledge to say to hospice people, we need his body, we need him here. We need to have time to grieve. And I think that this kind of situation may happen to some of us in this room with a loved one. And I think we need to be able to say, give me some time. Mm-hmm. So I was fortunate enough when my husband died, he died at home, and I wanted him there, and I was with him, and the hospice people phoned up, they wanted to come and take the bed. And I said, it's still occupied. So there was a long silence on the other end. Oh, well, do you mind if I give you a ring tomorrow? You know, and I was fortunate because Debbie and I think Corinne Dumbo and Adam Yatico, they came after my husband had died. They washed the body with me. You know, that's it must have been the good merit that he'd accumulated. So for me, the contrast between, you know, seeing the distraught way my mother-in-law was, they'd been married 53 years, and the guilt I felt in not being able to help her and to allow this kind of to happen. And then with that experience, being determined, you know, not to let it happen again. So for us in this Western culture, when, you know, we have hospitals and hospice, and then they want to get on with their job, and they're, okay, well, that's the end, the person's dead. But I think for the living, those of us who are left, we need to have the courage to say, give me some time. Give me some time to just be able to be with that loss, with that person. You know, stroke them, touch them, whatever. So.
Part of, I think that's really important, but part of when Mary's sister died 2 years after she died, the one that I got very close to, and I was there when she died, and we talked about washing the body, and they did wash the body, but her family didn't want it around very long. Right. And you just have to let that happen too. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of being sensitive to the situation.
Mm-hmm. I've actually been reflecting on that a lot because I've had a lot of family stuff going on. My grandfather passed away last month, and my elderly grandmother on my other side came to live with us. And I've been going through the grief process and going through sadness, but a certain amount of humor that has been coming with that as well, because my grandfather was in okay health. My grandmother was in denial about him slowly receding, and then his actual process, he went through it in about a week. And he was pretty lucky. He got the whole surrounded by family, being at home, nice comfortable bed, and died in his sleep. And people said, oh, you don't think he'll last the night, but he stayed until 7 in the morning just to prove them wrong. And a lot of interesting things happened on that score, and seeing the difference of just death is never the same for anyone or anything, because my grandfather was in really good health and then declined and very quickly, and my grandmother, she is blind, she's wheelchair bound, and she's mostly deaf, but she's otherwise as healthy as an ox. and she, at the same time, she's not the same person that I knew. And I had to actually, when she came to live with us, I had to let go of the person I once knew. Because it had actually been enough time, and she was a completely new individual, and she was a completely new person. So it's, she's my grandmother, but she's not, she's new at the same time. And it's been interesting reflecting on all those things. Also how the people surrounded by those who are aging and experiencing death watch it and respond and react to it. So.
Were you going to say something? I was wondering, you know, in your Dhamma talk, letting go of the wheel, there was a... sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Well, you'll remember the story. There was a man who he was about to be in a car accident, and he was about to... This man came out into his lane, and he, right before the car hit, he said, he thought, this is what we practice for. And he let go of the wheel. And I was wondering if there was like a metaphor there as far as letting go of...
Well, certainly in terms of that letting go, it's all you can do, really. That's, when it, there's death in your face, you don't start negotiating. you have to be willing to let go.
So do you just let your merit carry you? Or?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I can actually personally reflect on that somewhat, because a couple of years ago I was in a car accident. My car was hydroplaning in a really bad storm, and the wheel started shaking, and then the car just started spinning out of control. And I was in the commuter lane, so I was right next to the cement divide, and a very just calm, kind of curious voice came up and just, "Were you gonna die?" And I thought about it for the split seconds that I had, and I just looked at the cement divide we were going towards, and I said, "Well, let's hit the thingy and see where we're at." And so, yeah, I hit it, and I'm still conscious, so then I worked on stopping the car. But, yeah.
Yes, Julie.
Since we're offering reflections, is it okay to chime in with one more quick personal experience?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. I was just thinking, like, growing up, I was in a lot of car accidents, just randomly, and one of them, I remember, we had 2 bushels of peaches in the trunk, and it was dark out, and so when we woke up hanging from our seatbelts upside down in the ditch, that there were also these, like, 2 bushels of peaches that were just totally mushy underneath where the trunk was hanging open, because it was upside down. And so we crawled out of windows, and the policeman came up, and he stepped into the peaches, right? And it was dark. And so sort of, it was like a running joke in our family is how the policeman responded. You know, what came up for the police, because he clearly, I've heard, thought that he was stepping into a mushed up body rather than 2 bushels of peaches. And so for me, that's always, for me right now, I'm thinking that that's a very useful reflection, right? Because the power of the reaction is somehow related to the the way the policeman was pouring his heart into the peaches. I guess, and yeah, so.
Perception. Perception.
I have to say the because I had a dream last night that Iris was in. Uh-huh. And she said she wanted to tell me something. It was probably to pass it on. But she was unable to tell me.
Actually, I have something to add on that. On the last day of winter retreat, I came here, and the night before that, I dreamed that Iris called me, and in the dream, I mean, I dream silly dreams all the time, so I didn't tell anyone what happened. But now that she bring up. So in the dream, I forgot that Iris has gone, so I'm like, oh good, Iris, how are you? And she's like, I'm doing well, don't worry about me, I'm very happy. And then I realized she has gone. Like, and I'm like, I think in the dream I was going to call another friend to talk, but then I realized that Iris was gone. I'm like, so how did you come? And it's quiet from then on. I didn't hear anywhere from then. And I'm like, well, that goes in the dream is partially true. You know, she's okay. She said not to worry. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's nice. Maybe she's getting ready for the memorial service.
Yeah,
Edward has.
Edward.
You know, you mentioned before about, you know, in Buddhist cosmology, they just say it's that death is the dissolution of the body. And also, you spoke about awareness and you know, what that is and coming home. And I know that experience. And that experience is not the same as what we think is dying. The ordinary, you know, that experience, that aware experience does not have us see, and it's so difficult to talk about. The life that we think that we're leaving is not the life that we know about when we're aware.
Well, yeah, because it's, you know, what we're so tangled up with it and identified with it, you realize. And death comes, and it's like a something that's built up out of crystal, and then it just it's just a pile of rubble in the end. And it's just so important to be able to recognize that, you know, within that there is this possibility of that awareness and purity of heart. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can take the opportunity. It's about 4:30, which is about the end of our Upasika day timing. But I think we should end with a silent meditation. We've been, I think, we've had some great reflections, contemplations, discussions. Really fruitful. Thank everybody for coming and participating. And at this point, we can sit quietly for about 15 minutes. A long time is not too short, but just to be able to end the afternoon session with some quiet time and bring attention to the breath. Bring attention to the heart. Allow the heart to settle. There's a request for the five subjects for frequent recollection, which is 35, 39.
And
yeah,
that's
the passage. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, make
a note. Do I read on this? So the... Just not that. The next Upasaka day is June 14th,
maybe? Yes.
Check the website. Check the website or your email. If you're not on the Upasaka list, speak to Dennis or go on the website. And readings will be forthcoming in a more timely fashion.
And it's the Upasaka Renewal Day, so we'll be preparing trays, one tray for all of us who are renewing, and separate trays for first-time people. And the theme is the Thai forest traditions, which is what we had readings from during the retreat, so it promises to be very rich.
And it is the 14th.
Yeah, it is the 14th. Yeah, because the, when you say the overlying topic is devotion, so that sort of thinking in terms of that forming an object of our devotion.
Sarano yang kaman karisah.